We like to throw around the word revolution, but the birth and rise of the microcomputer really was a revolution. In 1981, IBM joined that revolution with the IBM PC, and it immediately took over the market. But the giant, for all of its vaunted power and resources, saw its leading place in the revolution slowly be taken away by the horde. We all know how the story ends, but how did it unfold, and what can we learn from it? In this video, how IBM lost its grip on the PC revolution. The first real indication that the microcomputer had staying power was the incredible success of the Apple II microcomputer. The Apple II produced an explosion of new software, including the first viruses. While self-replicating software had existed since the 1960s, they were called mainframe rabbits back then, the first computer virus appeared with the Apple II. Notably, 1981's Elk Cloner. Created by a high schooler, Elk Cloner caused an infected Apple II to show weird behaviors, including famously, on the 50th boot, it would show the infamous Elk Cloner poem. These early viruses were basically performance art, done for the sake of it because there was no money. But today's cybersecurity threats are far different, and that's why I want to introduce today's video partner, NordVPN. I've been using their Threat Protection Pro feature to surf the web in a safer way. For example, the search results safety indicator, which I find a nice touch when I'm clicking search results 8 pages deep on obscure topics. Not to mention DNS filtering for blocking ads and trackers. Besides that, NordVPN also acts as a VPN which keeps your internet traffic untraced or untracked, and thus keeps you safer online with a single click. Check out the link, nordvpn.com/agentometry. It's risk-free thanks to a 30-day money-back guarantee. I work at public cafes and airports all the time, which means logging onto their public Wi-Fi. And what worries me about that are man-in-the-middle attacks that can be used to intercept and steal private information or credit card credentials. 75% of people do not use a VPN to protect themselves while on a public Wi-Fi network, even though it's one of the best ways to protect your information. NordVPN has an exclusive deal with 4 months extra. Like I said, it's risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Check out the link below, nordvpn.com/agentometry. IBM wanted to do a microcomputer. The question was, how can a sprawling, history-bound organization like Big Blue keep up with the small and nimble startups of this early, fast-moving era? IBM had many times before attempted a product to enter the computing low end. In the early 1970s, they produced the SCAMP, a somewhat portable desktop computer. Later sold as the IBM 5100, it was cheap compared to IBM's other products, but at $10,000, still way more than an Apple II. Thus, in July 1980, with IBM lagging in microcomputers, William Lowe of the entry-level systems unit in Boca Raton, Florida, traveled up to the company headquarters in Armonk, New York, to make a proposal to the IBM Management Committee, the company's most powerful body. He had with him a prototype demo of the product he wanted IBM to build, the personal computer, or PC. It couldn't really do all that much, but that wasn't what Lowe was worried about. Lowe was most concerned about what the committee might say about his idea to go outside of the company to build and even sell the PC machine. But to him, this was the only way to sidestep the company's massive bureaucracy and deliver something powerful on time. In his view, previous products like the 5100 started off humbly, but slowly inflated their scopes due to input from various internal sales and development groups. This forced the software to be more complicated, in turn forcing hardware redesigns to accommodate. Lowe saw precedent for his approach. The successful Apple II microcomputer was almost entirely built with components sourced from outside vendors. The floppy drives came from Shugart, RAM and ROM from MOSTEC or NEC, boards from General Technology Corporation, so on. But the management committee, though seeing potential future issues with this unusual approach, nevertheless approved it. They figured any problems could eventually be fixed. One member later said, "The general attitude was that you don't have big problems in small markets, and we thought the personal computer was a very small market." They were wrong, of course, but I am getting ahead of myself. Though Lowe proposed the project, he was later reassigned to a different team. he handed duties over to Don Estridge. The dynamic visionary Estridge thus shepherded the team through a fast-paced year, putting the PC system together using the various off-the-shelf parts. Inspired by the Apple II's approach for having plug-in cards for additional functionality, Estridge adopted the same for the IBM PC. The specifications for the interfaces were published, allowing third parties to make expansion cards to extend the PC's functionality. Estridge also gathered together a small ecosystem of software packages, games, accounting, spreadsheets, and word processing. He was aided in this mighty task by Joyce Wren, an IBM renegade whose job was to go to outside vendors and convince them to adapt their software to the PC. However, the team was aware that certain critical parts came from third parties, like the central processor, which came from Intel, and the operating system, a modified version of Microsoft's MS-DOS, which they called PC-DOS. Moreover, many of the technical specs for the PC system were published in accessible literature. This potentially opened the door to a swarm of quote-unquote IBM-compatible clones, like an IBM PC, but without the IBM markup. This small problem became a much bigger one when the final IBM PC hit the market in August 1981. Armed with IBM's marketing muscle and quote-unquote open ecosystem, the PC quickly became the de facto standard. With that, it also became the number one target for the clone makers. The IBM team needed a way to deter them. So when modifying MS-DOS into PC-DOS, IBM decided to change the code for the PC's basic input-output system, or BIOS. The BIOS is a piece of low-level firmware. It's like a bridge controlling the signals going between an operating system and its computer hardware, keyboard, display, whatever. It also performs system checks, initializes memory, and writes characters to the screen. MS-DOS allows this BIOS to be implemented entirely as software. IBM, however, chose to implement a part of the PC BIOS as hardware, stored in a small read-only memory chip on the computer's board. The IBM team published its BIOS code in its IBM PC technical reference book. Sounds strange, I know, but the practice was not unusual at the time. Atari and Apple, too, published large chunks of the code in their reference manuals. Accessory partners needed to know this code to integrate with the system, for example. And by publishing the BIOS code, IBM can protect it via copyright. A few PC wannabes copied the BIOS code to make their clones. IBM sued them for it and won. Achieving compatibility required more than just the BIOS. For instance, several top softwares bypassed the OS entirely and directly manipulated hardware. So ensuring compatibility would require mimicking that hardware too. But generally speaking, so long as IBM controlled the BIOS, this critical bridge between hardware and software, then only IBM can make microcomputers that were fully compatible with the IBM ecosystem of software. It is September 1981, and three friends in Houston wanted to start a company. Jim Harris, William Bill Murto, and Joseph Rod Canyon were senior managers at Texas Instruments and in their late 30s. Jim and Rod were engineers and had been working together on various projects since 1972. Rod Canyon then met Bill in Austin in 1977 and found him a talented marketer. When Texas Instruments entered the Winchester drive industry, hard disk drives if you're not familiar with the name, Rod chose to work with Jim and Bill. The three eventually decided to start a company, not because they saw a glaring market opportunity, but because they wanted to work with people they respected in an environment they liked. Oh, and money too. But what would this company do? Their first substantial idea, a Mexican restaurant had initially been thrown around, was an add-on aftermarket Winchester hard disk drive for the IBM PC. At the time, only floppy drive add-ons existed, not HDDs. They took the idea to LJ7, one of the co-founders of the dynamic RAM firm MosTec, now venture capitalist, and his partner Ben Rosen. The two encouraged them to do it. So the three turned in their resignations and founded a corporation with the temporary name Gateway Technology. Then suddenly, Seven and Rosen got cold feet about the potential lifespan of a Winchester Drive add-on and backed out of their planned venture investment. Now what? During breakfast, Rod is pondering the microcomputer market and idly writing notes. He started thinking about the IBM PC's real strengths and realized that it wasn't the hardware, but rather its ecosystem of software programs, including those written by third parties. There were many microcomputers running the MS-DOS operating system. Microsoft was liberally licensing it out. But microcomputers like Hewlett-Packard's HP 150 or DEC's Rainbow 100 or Zenith's Z100 did not run PC-DOS. Lacking complete compatibility, such computers thus cannot run IBM's valued software, especially Lotus 1-2-3, the ecosystem's flagship spreadsheet program, which made them just another dog in the pile. At the same time, Rod and the team had seen a portable computer called the Osborne 1. It was a commercial success, but Rod thought it to be ugly, and he wanted something that could fit in an office. Thus, Rod smashed the two ideas together, a small portable computer that also ran all of the IBM PC software right out of the box. Emphasis on the all. A few IBM compatibles had already hit the market, but they were only partly compatible, as in it can only run just a selection of the most famous PC DOS softwares. Rosen joked that it was like being partly pregnant. LJ7, Ben Rosen, and the VC firm Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers decided to invest in this new idea, putting in about $1.5 million for a 55% stake into Gateway. Rosen became founding chairman. Now the team just had to make the product. How to do that? So the team started putting together a hardware prototype of the portable computer, named the Compact Portable, including a small 9-inch diagonal cathode ray tube screen. But getting the software was way trickier. In 1982, Gateway went to Microsoft for a version of MS-DOS compatible with PC software. Bill Gates declined to work with them on this. He then too much valued Microsoft's relationship with IBM. However, he did send over the exact version of the MS-DOS software he and Microsoft previously sent to IBM in 1980. So Gateway decided to do some reverse engineering. IBM's copyright on the BIOS code only protected those specific lines of code, rather than what that code actually did. But avoiding that copyright took a lot more than just changing a few lines and calling it a day. Gateway set up a clean room, quote-unquote, where a team of people slowly put together a BIOS without ever looking at the IBM BIOS code. It was a long, slow process that required a great deal of trial and error. There were two groups of people. One group read IBM's code and produced specifications on what the code should do. Those specifications were handed to another group of programmers who wrote code from scratch based on those specifications. Full compatibility with everything inside the IBM PC world was so critical that Rod recalls telling his team that, without it, they might as well shut down and give the money back to the investors. Over 15 people at Gateway were involved in the production of the reverse-engineered BIOS, and the effort cost the company $1 million. A few years later, a company called Phoenix Technologies followed the same path, but they licensed their BIOS out to manufacturers, which could then pair with a Microsoft MS-DOS license to make an IBM-compatible microcomputer. Gateway was not the first company to legally reverse-engineer the PC BIOS and bring a product to the market with it. That honor belongs to the startup Columbia Data Products, which released their MPC-1600 multi-personal computer a bit earlier in 1982. But the Compact Portable's compatibility was far better. Their unwillingness to accept compromises throughout the development process yielded significant benefits. Reviewers marveled at the Compact's ability to run PC software without any modification whatsoever. Moreover, the portable was more than just another ripoff. It was an IBM compatible that was also portable. I mean, at 28 pounds, you had to lug it around in a shopping cart, but everything, monitor, disk drive, so on, all that was in one package. IBM did not offer such a thing at all. And it was cheaper than IBM stuff. A Compact retailed for $2,995, while an equivalent IBM PC $3,735. This made it a fine second computer for office people who wanted to bring their work with them. The pitch is right in the headline, "The most computer you can carry." Finally, the company specifically targeted retail dealers who already sold IBM PCs, like Sears and Computerland. Such dealers preferred to sell the portable because Compaq gave them a bigger cut and was less often out of stock. And critically, the company did not have a direct sales force, so the dealers never felt that their own sales partner was competing against them. Such an approach was far more cooperative than IBM's. Dealer demand for the portable was off the charts, and the newly renamed Compaq Computer Company scrambled to ramp up their domestic manufacturing supply chain. They raised another $30 million from VCs, and then $75 million in loans from Houston banks to fund this effort. The company went from shipping 250 units in January 1983 to 10,000 a month in December, flooding shelves before competitors had a chance. Deciding to keep the supply chain in America was crucial in maintaining quality as volume ramped up. 1983 was a hard time for Texas, and energy dominated Houston in particular, so Compaq's expansion was a boon. Rod Canyon recalls the news came out about them hiring, and the line of applicants stretched around the block. The company's employees grew to 600 within a year. Compaq expected about $20 million in sales for 1983, already a very ambitious number. Based on dealer demand, however, the CFO projected $100 million of sales. Staggering. But even that fell short of the actual number. In 1983, Compaq shipped over 53,000 portables, producing $111 million in revenue. Their growth trajectory was so voracious that in December that year, they needed to sell shares to the public in an IPO to raise the necessary cash to keep building. Apple Computer was then the poster child for rocket ship success in the microcomputer industry, and it still took them 4 years to hit $100 million in revenue. Compaq blew past that. It was the most successful first year in American business history. Even so, Compaq knew they held a precarious position in a vicious neighborhood which included over 100 various competitors. From the very beginning, people entirely attributed Compaq's first-year success to IBM not having a portable and being unable to keep up with raging demand. So, many market observers felt that IBM can easily squash them flat, maybe by slashing prices or changing something in the PC to lock down the ecosystem again or coming out with something new. Compaq's backlog of orders could vanish overnight. But Compaq's co-founder, James Harris, told Businessweek in August 1983, "We realize a niche like this for an IBM PC-compatible computer doesn't last long, but we have a number of exciting products coming out too." In March 1983, IBM released its follow-up to the first PC, the PC XT. This computer did not change that much from its predecessor, with the exception of adding another hard disk drive. But while reverse engineering the XT, Compaq noticed that the new hard disk drive broke some of the PC's older software. So people who upgraded from the original PC to the XT also had to pay their software vendors to update their software packages. Who knows why or how IBM let this pass quality control? Perhaps they simply missed it. Perhaps they felt that since they owned the standard, the customers should simply go along with it. But IBM, like the U.S. Union General William Rosencrantz during the Battle of Chickamauga in 1863, did not know that they were leaving a gap in their battle lines, and that Compaq was positioning to run their forces right through it. In October 1983, Rod Canyon presented their second computer, the Compaq Plus. It might look the same, but there were two very significant differences. First, the Plus had this brand new 10-megabyte hard disk drive. At just 3.5 inches, the disk drive was small and light. Provided by a Scottish company called Rodeem, these Winchester drives were specially mounted inside a 5.25 inch drive mount to prevent data damage from physical shocks. The hard disk drive was the headlining feature, and what everyone in the press paid attention to. But perhaps far more importantly, from a strategic standpoint, was the Plus's backwards compatibility. At the Compaq Plus announcement, Rod Canyon said, "To us, Compatibility means to be able to run all PC and XT software off the shelf. In other words, Compaq was slightly expanding the PC ecosystem towards backwards compatibility. With the XT, IBM, whatever its intention, was trying to force its ecosystem to dance to its tune. Compaq was saying no. Later in the announcement, Canyon added, IBM has set a standard that all the third-party hardware and software companies have adopted. So, many customers are using software and hardware based on it. The standard doesn't really belong to IBM anymore. By early 1984, Compaq had turned this into a full-on talking point. In February 1984, Canyon told Computer World that the IBM PC had become a de facto industry standard, independent even of IBM, because of all the third-party software written for it. Compaq backed their words with action. Over time, Compaq's variant of MS-DOS gained a market reputation for good backwards compatibility. In late 1983, they licensed this variant back to Microsoft, allowing every other MS-DOS licensor to benefit. Every market analyst at the time recommended that Compaq stay in its portable niche and avoid taking on the IBM giant head-on. So, Compaq decided to get into desktop computers. In mid-December 1983, the company pulled together a team for a project called Bullet, as in faster than a speeding bullet. In just 6 months, they made the Desk Pro. Released in June 1984, the Desk Pro came out just 6 weeks before IBM dropped the IBM AT. Powered by the Intel 286 CPU, the AT was a bit faster than the Desk Pro, but it also cost significantly more, about $8,200, compared to the Compaq's $7,200. The PC AT was a seriously impressive computer with a very compelling price-to-performance ratio, and the company sold a lot of them. IBM's accompanying PC price cuts had a major impact on the PC clone market, and many of these companies went out of business in 1984. But there were a few issues. In the first few months, the IBM AT computers suffered serious manufacturing issues, likely due to inadequate testing of the controller for its 20-megabyte hard disk drive. And of increasing importance, the AT, again, lacked backwards compatibility with software written for older PC hardware, much more seriously this time. On the surface, IBM emerged from 1984 seemingly triumphant. They delivered annual profits of $6.58 billion, their highest yet, $1 billion more than second-place Exxon. They owned 63% of the IBM-compatible market and 41% share of the office computing market at large. Poor Apple was then in freefall, going from 22% to just 11%. Compaq also had a good year, surviving the PC downturn with $329 million in sales, 300% growth, and $12.8 million in profit. Mind you, that was only their second year in existence. Looking back at it, the IBM AT marked the last time the giant still held total grip on its ecosystem. After this, that valuable ecosystem starts to slip away from their grasp. In 1985, Intel had a new microprocessor, the 386. The 286 CPU, though quite good, had its flaws, particularly in how it multitasked between various modes. With the 386, on the other hand, Intel felt it had something really special, particularly with how it ran both 16-bit and 32-bit instructions. Despite this, IBM insisted on sticking with the 286, partly because they were concerned that the 386 was so powerful that it could cannibalize their sales of mini computers. But the biggest reason was that IBM wanted to take the PC back in-house, to take back control of the ecosystem. IBM retained the manufacturing rights for the 286 and opted to go forward with that, no matter even if the 386 was better. Same thing with the operating system. Since the early 1980s, there was a shared consensus that PCs needed a more intuitive interface than a terminal that you typed arcane commands into. The question was how to make that transition. For a while, Gates and Microsoft were working on a visual interface extension to MS-DOS called Windows. The first version, essentially a defensive measure, shipped in 1985, but did not sell very well. That same year, in the wake of the AT release, IBM and Microsoft started collaborating on a new operating system as a broad refresh of DOS. It was first called CPDOS and later renamed to DOS 5, DOS 286, Big DOS, and finally, OS 2. While IBM did consider dropping Microsoft to do this, they continued, perhaps because of sheer inertia, though with changed parameters. This time, IBM did the design, and Microsoft did the coding. But this deeper partnership quickly deteriorated. Cultural clashes between the IBM programmers who did things by the book but were resistant to change, and the Microsoft cowboys who did whatever it took but wrote unclear code. As the relationship deteriorated, MS-DOS grew in prominence. In 1986, Microsoft IPO'd, making Gates a billionaire at age 31, and many millions for its employees. IBM's people started to wonder why and how their former supplier had gotten to be so rich. Gates wanted IBM to help boost Windows in the market just as it did for MS-DOS. But in a meeting in 1986, William Lowe, then head of the IBM PC, told Gates that IBM will head off on its own for this next major step in the operating system. The two continued working together on the other parts of OS 2. IBM's attempt to walk away from Intel and Microsoft soon caused issues. Needing to find someone to sell its hot new chip to, Intel turned to Compaq, with whom they had previously worked together closely to iron out the 286's various issues. So the two worked together to produce the Desk Pro 386. This marked the first time where a company other than IBM introduced a leading technology to the PC market. Not waiting for IBM to make a 386 PC first was a huge risk, but Compaq did not want to wait. Rod Canyon called it the most powerful personal computer in the world. During the September 1986 introduction, Compaq brought out representatives from Microsoft, Intel, Lotus 1-2-3, and so on. Rod Canyon told the audience that now it was Compaq, Intel, and Microsoft setting the pace for the industry, not IBM. We were not held back by IBM. We were able to leverage the industry standard and add to it without regarding to what IBM was doing. The ability to move on to the next thing without any penalty or pain of separation is absolutely the most powerful force in the market today. IBM was pissed. Intel was where it was because of IBM, lifted them up by choosing them for the PC. So for IBM to see Intel turn around and help a direct competitor wrestle the PC standard away from them left bitter feelings. IBM broke off whatever non-contractual relationship it still had with Intel, including non-contractual purchasing and custom code development initiatives. They also sold their 20% share of the company. But Intel nevertheless kept selling their fast chips to the clone makers. Compaq's revenues, along with all the other clone makers, continued to surge. In 1986, Compaq entered the Fortune 500, the youngest company to ever do so. Compaq's self-coronation as the leader in the PC industry shocked IBM, and now they were determined to take back control of the personal computing industry. In April 1987, IBM announced the Personal System 2, or PS2 family, consisting of four computers. New IBM chairman, John Akers, personally insisted that they be called systems to evoke the IBM mainframes of old. The PS2 introduced things that many people might recognize today. For example, the Video Graphics Array, or VGA standard for displaying graphics at 640 by 480 pixel resolution. And that was really good back then. It made the mouse a standard for the PC, reflecting IBM's expectation that the PC's future interface would be graphical. And for a long time, many mice used the PC2's iconic mouse port until USB and then Bluetooth finally took over. And the 3.5-inch floppy disk, smaller, denser, and cuter too. First made by Sony and then picked up by Apple for their Macintosh, the 3.5-inch floppy is a fundamental memory of every computer-savvy kid. But the thing most technical observers quickly focused on was an obscure bit of the system called the bus. The bus transfers data between the PC's various pieces of hardware, kind of like a highway. It shares few physical features with a literal bus, which is a vehicle that, in Taipei, carries people from one spot to another at terrifying speed. The PC-2 had changed the AT's old open bus. That effort began a year earlier, when the team had to re-engineer the bus for radio frequency interference reasons. This re-engineering necessitated changes in the existing layout of the metal pins in the slot connections between the circuit boards and expansion boards. William Low decided to take advantage of this change to introduce a brand new PC bus standard called the micro-channel architecture. The micro-channel expansion bus worked better than the old 16-bit bus, but it also obsoleted most existing add-on peripherals and accessories. And its first version was deliberately hobbled so that IBM can later magically introduce a faster micro-channel 2. And finally, the operating system. IBM's vision was to use the new OS that it was developing in collaboration with Microsoft, OS 2. As I mentioned earlier, OS 2's headlining feature was a next-generation graphical user interface, or GUI. IBM has abruptly changed its systems before, always setting off a scramble by IBM-compatible makers. But what was different this time was how IBM aggressively asserted its presumed rights over this new ecosystem. Anyone wanting to make an expansion board for the PS2 needed licenses, and the terms were onerous. 5% of revenue not only for every PS2 clone sold, but also every PSAT and XT clone too. IBM also put special effort to make the PS2 as difficult as possible to clone, laying a variety of technical, economic, and legal traps. First, unlike with the original PC, the PS2 computers had a lot of custom stuff, circuit boards, sockets, etc., that cannot be found on the shelf. So each little thing has to be closely scrutinized and reverse engineered. Second, IBM extensively applied for patents for a great deal of the system's hardware and software. At the time of the PS2's release, nobody knew what those patents entailed, but IBM made it clear that many of those will not be licensed out. And perhaps most tricky of all, the PS2 makes heavy use of application-specific integrated circuits, or ASICs, custom chips. These custom chips perform many of the device's critical functions, and their masks/designs are protected by the Semiconductor Chip Protection Act of 1984. IBM knew it was impossible to cut off every cloning attempt. Their intention was to make it economically impractical to quickly produce a compatible PS2 clone, leaving only IBM with the market. As a final push to get everyone to adopt these new standards, IBM announced that it would quit selling their older PCATs. The AT was the best-selling IBM PC up until then, and having it cut off caused the sales of clone makers like Compaq to soar. Compaq reported $1.2 billion in revenue in 1987, one of the fastest ever companies to hit the billion-dollar revenue mark. But people feared that IBM was finally pinching off the future of the IBM-compatible industry. One senior executive at ARCO, the oil company, told a Compaq salesperson, "IBM sets the standards. IBM drives the standards, and if IBM wants to, then it can lock out all PC vendors." Even so, a few customers balked at adopting something so incompatible with what they had already. For instance, the Union Bank of Switzerland's securities division had custom designed its communication boards using the IBM AT bus. The new micro-channel boards will force them to redesign the whole thing and build new ones at higher cost. In the end, though, corporate buyers will probably buy millions of PS2 computers. IBM owned them. But what about the ordinary consumer? Would they really care what the buses were? And should the rest of the industry follow, and in doing so pay IBM's high licensing fees? Over the next year and a half, a massive debate arose as the industry braced for the PS2's forthcoming market entrance in 1988. Soon after the April 1987 announcement, the head of the major clone makers began voicing doubt about making PS2 clones, while still leaving the door open to it, just in case. The argument soon narrowed down to the micro-channel bus. It carried data faster, but was that so necessary when the AT bus's technical limits had still not yet been reached? Everyone saw what IBM was playing at. But if Compaq presented an alternative, would anyone follow, considering that Compaq itself was the number two in the market? In a product strategy meeting, they came up with the idea of uniting the other PC makers behind a backwards compatible alternative. Compaq quit working on the micro channel and started technical work on a new standard. Meanwhile, Canyon brought the idea to Bill Gates, who immediately gave it his full support, pledging to help recruit other PC companies to the cause. Intel was a bit more skeptical at the start, but came on board when Compaq offered them the opportunity to supply the ASIC chips for the new standard. Then, throughout the summer of 1988, Compaq approached its competitors, the PC clone makers, with Gates encouraging them to listen closely to the proposal. AST Research, Seiko Epson, Hewlett-Packard, NEC, Olivetti, Tandy, Wyze, and Zenith signed on. In September 1988, the nine companies announced that they would extend the old PC AT-style bus and offer it as an alternative standard to the IBM microchannel. The new standard was called the Extended Industry Standard Architecture, or AISA. Together, these nine companies controlled 33.5% of the 1987 PC market, as compared to IBM's 26.8%. The Wall Street Journal called it the Revolt of the Clones, calling the nine clone makers the Gang of Nine. That Intel and Microsoft sent Vice Presidents Albert Yu and Steve Ballmer to speak at the Gang of Nine announcement said everything. IBM's early critical partners, once beholden to the giant's wishes, were now running the show. IBM's experience with OS 2 was the final topping on the cake. The work between Microsoft and IBM continued on, and what was feared before was happening again. OS 2 grew in scope, and by late 1986, Gates was telling IBM that the OS was so bulky that it would be better if it ran on the Intel 386 chip. They, of course, said no. In the end, when the OS 2 version 1.0 finally shipped in December 1987, it only ran in text mode. The headlining GUI feature was not scheduled to hit the market until 1988. So, OS 2 did not have much to distinguish it at the start. Nevertheless, virtually every market analyst at the time confidently predicted that OS 2 would overtake DOS, just like how DOS overtook its older forerunner CPM. That did not happen. IBM's own graphics interface feature hit the market later in 1988, just in time to suffer from a debilitating memory chip shortage in wake of the 1986 US-Japan semiconductor trade agreement. By then, Intel and Microsoft had transformed into the metaphorical weapons dealers, fueling a wave of anonymous companies slapping together anonymous PC clones at increasingly lower prices. Intel chip, Microsoft OS, that was all you needed. The rest was a commodity. In 1990, Microsoft released Windows 3.0. The first two Windows iterations were awful and failed, but this one sold 14 million copies in just 10 months. IBM, on the other hand, only sold about 300,000 copies in the 3 years after OS 2's release. Afterwards, they took full control of it and funneled billions of dollars into its development, but to no avail. The PS2's technologies delivered excellent improvements at very reasonable prices, and they were much appreciative. Had IBM not been so aggressive in closing off its ecosystem, then one can argue that the rest of the industry would have cloned IBM's new products and then adopted them as the new standard, just as it done before. But IBM wanted to retain control of a standard that they saw as spiraling out beyond their reach. Ironically, their attempts to squeeze that grip caused the ecosystem to slip out of their fingers. I am reminded of another situation like this, an American icon in a new exciting technology, AT&T and Unix. Unix was this unique thing that AT&T sought to monetize. Their heavy-handed attempts to do so lost them the market. In the end, IBM went off on its own in the PC world, and that was fine, because their heart really was in the mainframe. That was their everything, and in the end, they returned to it. For those remaining, a wave of competition loomed ahead. All right, everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.